episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host, researcher, and friend, John McKinnon, author of The Persuasive Preacher, The Gifted Prophet, and The Noble Politician. John, it's good to be back and to talk about all things failure. I'll admit, this is probably going to be one of the more difficult podcasts that we have done. At some point, there has to come some self-reflection. Whenever you believe something that you thought was true, you told other people was true, and you would have actually died to defend the truth of what you believed, and then you find out that it wasn't quite true. What do you do with this? And for many people, this is the struggle. This is why groups survive. And today we're getting into how a group handles failure, because that's really what the deciding factor should be on whether a group is healthy or a group is not healthy. If a group can handle failure correctly and move forward correctly, it shows that they have some, you know, at least they have some method in which they can refine and correct the things that are incorrect and move forward in a good way, move forward in a truthful way. But whenever a group does not move forward in a healthy way after a failure, it really shows the internal makeup and integrity of the group. And for me, this came to be a huge problem as I was starting to unravel the things that I believed. Whenever I first began this journey, it was in September, I believe it was, of 2011. I would have actually died to defend this movement that we came out of, and it was very difficult for me. I would never forget the first time I came across any critical information about William Branham. It was 2011. I never even knew there could be anything that was negative to say. And my first thought was immediately, touch not God's anointed. And when I had the thought, I remember thinking, you know, I shouldn't think about this. That's God's anointed. But I also kept going back to the fact that if you read that passage where it says, touch not God's anointed, do God's prophets no harm, that was a completely separate thought than you should test the prophets. You should see if their prophecies are true. Those are two valid passages in the Bible. And my mind went to the touch not God's anointed. Why? Because that's how I was trained to believe. That's what I was trained to do. More to the point, that's how I was trained to respond. And the next thing that hit me was, well, wait a minute. This person is critically analyzing the ministry of William Branham. Why did nobody do this whenever he was alive? And it's funny, if you read the comment feeds, you'll see people ask that same question. But the more I thought about it, that was not really coming from me personally. That's not a thought that I had. That was a thought that was put up here by somebody else. Because William Branham himself, in his own ministry, said that 300 ministers rose up against him for one reason or another. He mentions this multiple times. And he talked about groups that were trying to, you know, expose him, etc. So people were rising up against him. I just did not know the level of in which they were rising up, but there were people, and he admitted it. So I knew the truth on one hand, but I had the response on the other hand. And I think that is really critical to understand, because how a person responds who is in a movement really depends on how they've been trained to respond in that movement. And the question comes down to be, it's not a question about the person or the person's integrity. The question actually comes to the group. Does the group have integrity? And anyway, today we're getting to that. It's going to be a wild journey, wild ride. I'll admit it's going to be painful, because there are things I'm going to admit that I went through, and I, like anybody else who is in one of these groups, they can say the same thing, and I want to move forward in a healthy way. So thank you for coming back. Let's get into this.
Well, John, the more I study all these things we've been talking about, you know, the deeper it goes, and the more I really understand now fully, you know, how these things came together to, you know, deceive us. And, you know, it just goes to show that things don't always appear like they are on the surface. A lot of times there's things you really need to look underneath the surface to really find out the truth of what you're believing. So I'm glad we're digging into these things, because I'm hoping it's, you know, telling a story here. But, you know, everything we've shown so far about how to start a cult, you know, is embedded in these ministers that rise up to proclaim their own truth, to, you know, break away from the mainline Christian church, to try to be unique. And, you know, I understand what their purpose is to try to bring truth to the church. But people that get off into these areas who may have found a trail they could run on, it usually leads to nowhere. And that's what's happened in all these movements, you know, that leads to nowhere. Because today we're going to discuss something that's a really exciting topic. And for us with more logical, critical thinking minds, you know, we do examine everything that's happening, you know, in the real world and what everybody's predicting, to make sure we're on solid ground. So we're going to see some of these things as we go along. Today will be more of a background to get ready for the next episode, where we'll dive into the actual false prophecies, because that's what we're focusing on today, is false prophecies that are used to create your own cult. But if anything I believe cannot stand challenges, you know, if I believe something cannot stand the challenges and be backed up by more than one witness, then there's reason to be concerned, you know, with what I'm believing. You know, this is the fifth episode of How to Start Your Own Cult. So the first four episodes really laid the groundwork, creating the character of the person. So if you're a person that's out there trying to be somebody and to be the important one for the hour, then you've got to create your character. You've got to create your stage persona, where you come from, how you were brought about by God to come be who you are, you know, how he called you. And then you gain that following, starts gaining momentum by promoting yourself. So you first start out, have to promote yourself. And before long, if people start believing you, then they'll promote you. So this is the basis of how cults really get started. It lies in reality that we all want to feel important. And some people, however, want to feel more important than others. So when a charismatic, gifted leader, and we know there's people born in this world with the gift of being able to have a lot of charisma and drawing people after themselves, you know, without any church doctrine. So we know when they begin to assert their uniqueness, though, within the church, and that they have higher powers than other people, you know, a cult of personality begins to form there. And they all have similar patterns, and that's what we're looking at here, is those patterns, regardless of what doctrines, you know, they're preaching. That's the basis of what we're exploring. So the patterns and the framework of all high-control cults, which they all eventually become, but to keep their followers in check and keep them, you know, dedicated, that's they all follow those same patterns that all these groups and the unhealthy ones share. So what we're tackling today is really fascinating. It's mind-bending, and false prophecies do get promoted as true. And then eventually over time, people begin to believe them. And by the time the leader's gone, people are repeating them as if they were true. You know, today is going to be a lot of groundwork. So I understand that. There's a lot of background that we need to cover, so that when we go into the actual prophecies, people can have this episode to understand where we're coming from. Because we have to fully understand how people, you know, even though we can show clearly that prophecies were not coming to pass, how they can continue to hold their belief system even after the failures. And you would think people would just abandon their whole belief system and start over right after a failure, since that proves that what they believe was not even true, nor it could not be from God, and would obviously it would discredit the prophet. And that's how a majority of us think. But it actually does just the opposite. If your mind is working according to how the majority of people think, you know, these groups actually tend to hold on even stronger. You know, to come out of a group like this, there has to be some triggering event or some event that leads up to where you're really questioning, you know, why you're in this group in the first place, or believe in what they believe. So for those still trapped in the groups that we may mention today, you know, we're going to explore eventually in the next episode at least, several bold predictions about the end times and about divine interventions that were possibly during their ministry that happened, or even world-changing events that they proclaimed that never came to pass. You know, these include doomsday dates, you know, that fizzled out, to even promise utopias, when we maybe mentioned John Alexander Dowie, his promised utopia that crumbled. You know, these failed prophecies should have exposed the cracks in the foundations of what they were doing in these organizations a long time ago, but we'll discover that these groups don't die after the leader's proven false. They actually begin to tighten up, and the followers start to defend the groups even more. And there's several reasons for that we'll go into. So to illustrate what we're talking about here, you know, think back to the early Adventist dates. This is back in the 1800s, mid-1800s. They set a date of 1844, where Christ was going to come. And to them and to their followers, that became what was called the Great Disappointment. You know, when many people left the group at that time, but they still kept a following, you know, even though many left. And Jehovah's Witnesses even set a date of 1914, where Armageddon was going to set in. And then they began to shift to timelines when that didn't come to pass. Mormon prophecies, they've had prophecies in the past about temples and gatherings, and they never materialized. And then we get to where we came out of, William Branham. He forecasted the end of the world in 1977, which we know that didn't materialize. You know, as we've done before, and I'll also explore, you know, other prophecies of William Branham that he used to support his claim of being the last true prophet of God for this day, because of our familiarity with it. You know, that's the only reason I'm focusing on it. We'll only use the facts and let the facts just speak for themselves. We have no other purpose in doing it but just to present, you know, the actual facts of the matter. And I'll be objective in the analysis and break these things down with actual events and historical context and fairness. But I know, John, that even though we can easily show that these leaders spoke false prophecies in the name of the Lord, because of how people are made up psychologically, you know, the followers that are really into this, they'll find a way to blur the lines, smooth out the things that were said, as if it appears the prophecy was not false at all, but it could have been spoken in some other way for some other purpose. It allows our minds to avoid these disturbing facts that they're being presented with. They don't want to be presented with disturbing facts, and we'll find out why too.
That's exactly right. Like I said, whenever I was presented with disturbing facts, I was not able to respond as myself. I was responding in the way that I was trained to respond. And in all other aspects of life, that's not me. In fact, people who know me, they'll say I'm a little bit open and blunt about the things that I say. Whenever I see something that might be off a little bit, I'll say, hey, look, there's something wrong here. Dig into this. Especially, I'm in the IT world, so if there's something that we're planning, a project or whatever, if there's a potential for error in the project or the design of the project, I'm the first one to open up and say, hey, wait a minute, guys, let's think through this a little bit more. But whenever it came to religion, even though I was in the IT world, I didn't do this. Why didn't I do this? And it all comes back to the fact that when an unhealthy group is presented with disturbing facts, very critical facts, the first inclination is to defend the error rather than try to determine the truth. And for me, that's backwards. And for every Christian, that should be backwards. If you believe something and you're trying to defend something that might be an error, then by default, you too are in error. So whenever I came across this critical information in fall of 2011. And the very first thing that hit me was, wait a minute, this person is calling William Branham a false prophet. And to that point in time, I had never, ever even thought there could be a possibility that he had a failed prophecy. He would often say things like, if you see one single thing failed, you can put a sign on my back that says false prophet. And that was a defense mechanism for me. If somebody ever challenged me, that's what I went to. He himself said, you can put a sign on his back that said false prophet. And I would go there rather than examine what the person said that was critical, because I was trained to respond in a certain way. But whenever I was presented with disturbing facts that I really couldn't argue with, the person was going through one of the prophecies, I can't remember which, but laying out very clearly the facts, I started to look at the facts, and I could see that the sum of the facts was not in favor of Branham. I'll just say it like that. But one little detail among the entire set of details for the specific prophecy, one little detail might have been true. And I say that with caution, might have been true. My mind immediately went to the thing that might have been true and ignored all of the facts that clearly weren't true. And whenever this happened, like I said, there were things going off in my brain that I just could not explain. Why was I responding this way? That's not how I am. That's not John Collins, right? So I was presented with the disturbing facts. My brain immediately defended the error, and I was trained to not look at the truth. So fast forward to today. I'm going through all of these different ministries, as you know, and there's huge problems with the church today. Recently, Sean Foyt, he doesn't claim to be a prophet, but if you read the title and verbiage of some of his YouTube videos, et cetera, it's always hinting at prophecy. Now, he's talking about the prophetic for 2025 in one place and, you know, all of these different things. If you were to be in one of his meetings, I've not been in a meeting, but I'm assuming based on that, he would say things like, I never said I was a prophet. And I thought through things like that because William Branham would say the same thing. I never said I was a prophet. You said I was a prophet. And yet at the same time, he's giving prophecy. So why would you even say this in the first place? It is a deflection. That's what I came to learn. It is a deflection. But more than that, it gives the person a programmed response for somebody who claims that William Branham was a false prophet. Because the second thought that went through my head as I examined the false prophecy was, well, he never said he was a prophet. Why did I say that? It was because he was training me to believe this, yet his entire ministry was based on this alleged seven prophecies of 1933. Depending on which version of those seven, they all differ, I began to realize that there's something not quite right here. And at that point in time, and in fact, even after I started my website and blog, believe it or not, I still believe William Branham was a prophet. I just thought there were some issues with the prophecies, and I wanted to know why. And so I approached my grandfather. I told him I was looking at one of the prophecies, which I'll get into that in a bit. But I explained that there were some issues with one of the prophecies, and Branham himself admitted that the prophecy did not come true. And so if he admitted it, and yet at the same time he's saying, if you find one that's not true, put a false sign on his back, shouldn't he have not put the sign on his back? So I asked my grandfather, and I'll never forget this. He said, John, people have known these things for years. Why does it hurt for you to believe it anyway? And that instantly told me at that point in time that he knew, and the way he said it implied and suggested that other people knew. And if other people knew, why were they not telling other people? Why would you not simply say, hey, we're in error. There's something wrong here. Let's move away from error into truth. And that was when I was first hit with the thought of integrity. A group who has integrity will move towards truth, not try to remain in error. So anyway, what was it like for you? When did you first begin to learn that there were issues with William Branham's prophecies?
I really didn't start to discover or even believe William Branham had false prophecies. It was only until after I left the message and really began to doing a deep dive. My reason for leaving was a totally different reason. False prophecies was not the reason I left, but I had seen things presented on YouTube about it. And I just my mind hadn't come to that place to where I could really understand it. Because of the brainwashing. So here's the real mind bender we're going to try to dissect here. You know, including myself, you know, why do members stick around? even when prophecies flop spectacularly, why don't more people walk away? Well, there are several concepts going on that we're going to explore. One is being cognitive dissonance, or the community bonds, or fear of the outside world because they've been sheltered so much, or even the sunk cost fallacy. And we don't have time to deep dive into each of these phenomena or the psychology of the people who are really in these types of situations, but it's a real phenomenon here. It's been thoroughly researched and documented. And I don't mean to be critical, you know, of anyone's belief, but when a group proclaims itself to be the necessary channel and the only means of salvation offered to escape the wrath of God, you know, I certainly believe it's well within our rights and our duty and responsibility to research this material and to find out, you know, if it's true or not. And then it's fair game to analyze all their public statements, you know, with what the reality is, and then present it to others, you know, good or bad, where the chips may fall. So I think that's what we're doing here is well within the bounds of what we're, you know, should do.
Exactly. I mean, like I said, there are passages in the Bible that say to test the prophets, and yet we were trained in such a way that we could not do this. And I started to think through the reasons why that would be, and I really could only think of one reason why a person would not want others to test their prophecies. So I started studying the scriptures. I started digging deeper and deeper into the Bible. I read it over and over and over again to just wash all of what was in my head out. And I came across the passage in the New Testament talking about the believers in Berea. I had read that before, but I had never really thought through the significance of it. This is a group of people who were doubters. This is a group of people who were critically examining the ministry. They had heard about Christianity. They wanted to know, is it true? So they started reading through, and they, sadly, it doesn't say what they found or why, but they came to the conclusion through study and research that this is true. We want to become Christians. So I started reading the Bible, doing the same thing. I actually went beyond Branham whenever I did this because I realized at that point that I had never done what they had done. I believed William Branham because I was told that William Branham was a prophet of God. And now I'm suddenly coming to terms with the fact that if he was a prophet, he had some prophecies that had huge flaws. At that point, I hadn't really understood the failures. But I'm reading through this, and I'm trying to make sense of it. I came to the point where I realized I can't just stop there. I have to go beyond Branham and study Christianity. And I started just digging deeper. I read the Bible so many times I lost count, cover to cover. And the thought hit me that what I was trained to do in response to the failures was a direct result of the failures themselves. Whenever there's something that is potentially dangerous to the integrity of the group, the group must have a defense mechanism to keep people from leaving the group. And I came in contact with Dr. Stephen Hassan. I started reading his book, Combating Cult Mind Control. And it started talking about the way the group think works, how basically all of the defense mechanisms to support the group. And it was saying in much different words what I was coming to terms with. It all goes back to the integrity of the group. If the group has integrity, they will self-reflect. They'll examine what's true, what's false, and they'll eradicate the error and they'll move towards truth. I realized that I personally was not doing this, and I was remaining in error. Even after leaving, believe it or not, after leaving and even after starting my blog, going through this stuff, I was trying at that point to prove William Branham to be true. And the way that my mind works, to prove the truth, I will study the false. And if the false turns out to be true, then my truth is not the version of true that is actually true. So I'm studying all of this out and coming to terms with the fact that I was in a groupthink mindset, and that got me into studying mind control, which I, at that point, I thought was science fiction. But it led me down the path of learning that the people themselves aren't really at fault. It's the group and the group's integrity that's at fault, usually the result of the central figure of the group. And that's something I'd not really thought through. Our group had a central figure, and that was William Branham. Until he died, he was the central figure. Then after he died, he became a central figure immortalized, which is really, the more I thought about it, the more it was really odd. And I had looked at other groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Mormons, and I can, even in the cult, I considered them to be a cultish or destructive group. I started to look at the way that they supported their dead leader, and I was asking myself the question, did I not do the same thing? So I went through this process of self-reflection and came to learn that, yes, I was probably subjected to a bit of mind control, but I did not yet know, was it purposeful? Was it a purposefully implemented strategy that they were doing to my head, or was it just something that happened over time? And that's a question that I'm still digging into.
You know, you're right on point with that one, John. The techniques of mind control are being practiced today within these groups, and there are a lot of reasons why these groups stay so cohesive in the midst of severe challenges to their beliefs. And, you know, I think the message is receiving its most severe challenge as ever, and it's a good study group to actually start looking at and seeing what's happening. And it's going to follow the same patterns that was seen back in 1956 when this other study was going on with a completely different group and completely bizarre, you know, beliefs. And it goes for people that are pseudo-Christians as well as non-Christian groups as well. So it doesn't matter what type of group you're in, these same concepts apply. Yeah, so to get the background of this, we're going to review some details of the book that was written in 1956 to study, you know, a similar doomsday cult, but it was a cult believing in aliens. And so the book was called When Prophecy Fails. It's a classic sociological study by Leon Festinger, Henry Ryken, and Stanley Schachter. It examines what happens after a clear prophetic prediction fails. And it crucially, you know, why believers often don't abandon that belief, you know, and that's what you can actually take what we're having today and apply it to any group, you know, that holds on to false prophecies. So When Prophecy Fails presents one of the earliest field studies of cognitive dissonance, and that's what they termed it. It examines how a group reacts when apocalyptic prophecy does not occur or does not come to pass as they predict it. And the work became a foundational work in social psychology and the study of belief persistence. And that's what we're dealing with here. You know, people that have deep-seated beliefs will hold on to those beliefs for various reasons. And we're going to explore and explain these reasons here shortly.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
So the book argues that failed prophecy does not automatically destroy beliefs. Instead, under certain conditions, failure can actually strengthen the commitment of the believers. And the authors explain this whole concept by using the term they term cognitive dissonance. It's a psychological tension. That's how it's defined. Your mind gets under tension psychologically with what you experience when your reality of what you're observing in the real world contradicts what you're deeply holding as your belief system. Now, your belief system's intangible, but I believe what we're seeing in the external world is tangible. So you've got one thing that's reality versus intangible versus the tangible coming together, and they're conflicting, and there's a rub there. So the person actually has to change who they are almost to matched reality. So in a sense, if they don't change who they are to match reality, they're holding on to these beliefs that are clearly proven to show that they're not true, then they're under some kind of, it may be mild, it may be, could be even severe, but they're holding on to some sort of psychosis, because at that point, they are no longer experiencing reality. Now they're in a fantasy world. So cognitive dissonance is the psychological discomfort that a person experiences when they hold two or more conflicting beliefs, or when their beliefs conflict with observable reality or their own actions. And because this discomfort becomes unpleasant to them, people are strongly motivated to resolve this conflict or reduce it. And often they do that without changing their original belief. That's the core thing, is they will not go first to their changing their belief system. You have to have a willing heart to do that. You have to have an open heart to do that. When you're closed off and the group has taught you so much to close you off to the outside world, that's the mind control. And that's what's motivating the people in the message and any other group that forces you to, say, believe this or else. It forces them into that belief system. That's why they never go to changing their beliefs as a starting point. It's always, we've got to find some way to disprove what we're confronted with. So the case study in this book, it centers on a small apocalyptic group. It was led by a woman who predicted a specific date for the destruction of the world, claiming her messages were from aliens or extraterrestrial beings. The book chronicles a study by somebody that infiltrated the group and became one of the believers in a way to study the group. And the pseudonym for the woman, or the pseudonym for the person going in, was Marion Keach. It's just a name made up so his name would be protected. But the group actually believed that aliens would rescue them from a flood that was going to destroy the world on a specific date. The authors that wrote the book and the collaborators with them joined the group covertly to just observe what was happening as a study when this prophecy failed. So it being a very soon to come to pass prophecy, they had a very opportune time to get in there and study and provide some research for the furtherment of sociology and how people act in this world. So the key features that had to be present was a specific time-bound prophecy, not something way off thousands of years in the future. Members also made specific major sacrifices to be part of this group and to be part of this prophecy. For instance, they quit their jobs. They sold all their possessions. They gave all their money to the group. They cut off their outside relationships. And we find that's the pattern in these high-control groups, that a lot of these things, one or more of these things, can happen. Because you are convinced so strongly, back when William Branham's prophecy in 1977 was given, which he said was not a prophecy, but his prediction of that even caused people to quit their jobs, caused people to sell all they had, maybe caused people to get married just so they could experience marriage before the 1977 prophecy came to pass, which they believe was a prophecy. So those things happen within the message. So it's not uncommon. It's very common. We found it happening probably in the Adventist group of David Koresh. All the people there joined his compound. We found it happen maybe in Jim Jones's compound. All the people quit their jobs and all and went with his group, and they moved out to Guyana. So it happens over and over. Whether you still continue to live in the society or join a commune, these elements are present in what you believe. And they also enjoy a shared community. And this shared community amongst themselves only reinforces their belief system, because they're bouncing things off one another, never getting a critical view of their belief system. It's always reinforcing. It's always confirmation bias. It's never somebody from the outside, because they're not let in. So when this prophecy fell back in 1956, you know, the world didn't end. And the group, however, did not break up. They didn't dissolve. Some may have left. But the group stayed intact for at least for a time. So let's explore, you know, what happened here after that prophecy failed. You know, the authors interpreted the group's intensified efforts to proselytize even more after this failure as evidence of cognitive dissonance, the discomfort they were experiencing. They went out and actually evangelized even more, probably telling other people that, oh, the world was spared from this flood, from the destruction, just so that we can invite you to come in to this group. They felt like because they were still here that God spared the world and they were to go out and bring more believers in. So when they were faced with this disconfirmation of their beliefs, they resolved it by not abandoning the faith that they had, but they reinforced it by a lot of new rationalizations and then outreach. So here's what they did. They reinterpreted the failure. And that's what happened in many cases. If the world would have ended in 1977, well, believers would have been first to say William Branham's prophecy was true, and they would have called it a prophecy. But because it didn't come to pass, oh, it was only a prediction, and it was not didn't have to be fulfilled. The same way when we're expecting a woman president at some point to fulfill a 1933 prophecy, the minute we have a woman vice president or someone running for president, we automatically go to the prophecy and say, that's the fulfillment of it. And we find ways to look at what's happening and weave that into the prophecy. And if they were elected, we would say it's the fulfillment. And then if things didn't pan out the way the prophecy was laid out, we would say, well, it was only one of many. There's more to come. So we reinterpret the failure every time. The people that back then in that day was saying the world was spared because of our faith. You know, I can think back to Perry Green's book, The Acts of the Prophet. In his earlier versions, you know, he was dead on mentioning about Billy Paul Branham's testimony about William Branham saying, you're not going to die, or you're not going to be even an old man before there's going to be sharks swimming all around where you're standing. And that was in front of the May Company in downtown Los Angeles, because he prophesied, and we've got this on record, and that's one of the ones we'll go over next time, but it's on record that it's a thus saith the Lord. And when we look at that in a critical view, it's really strange how they can still hold on to that. But so the original version declared in that book of Perry Green's, it declared it was a prophecy concerning his son's age, and he mentioned it was a prophetic statement. But newer versions that came out, because he was forced to revise the versions about the cloud and about all he said about the cloud back in 1963 in Arizona, he was forced to revise that as the truth came out. So he also revised this as well and just called it a prediction, or just a personal prediction, not even a prophecy. So they also claimed, If a prophecy fails, they will claim us a partial or invisible fulfillment. So we can say, well, when a woman was elected as vice president, it was a partial fulfillment for more to come. Or you could think back when seven angels were supposedly to come to William Branham in the cloud, and it was determined that the cloud had nothing to do with seven angels and had nothing to do with William Branham because he was in Texas at the time. Then the believers will start saying, well, the angels came to him by vision. And it was days later after the mysterious cloud appeared. Or the angels came to him and nobody noticed it because the cloud appeared ahead of time to show they were here, and then they came to him privately afterwards. So the prophecy keeps getting reinterpreted. But for some ministers who were more honest, you know, once the cloud was found to be a rocket explosion that was detonated by the military because of a failed launch, and it was actually 200 miles away from Tucson to where William Branham, even if he was there, would not have even been able to just look up and see the cloud because it was 200 miles away. They actually stopped mentioning the cloud altogether in their sermons, and I commend them for that, because I would have done the same thing too. I wouldn't have helped mentioning the fact that he was underneath the cloud as he spoke in his sermons. I wouldn't have mentioned that. I just would avoid it. And that's the way we resolve this cognitive dissonance in our minds. We don't discredit William Branham for the cloud hoax, but we just find a way to explain it and say, well, I'm just not going to mention it anymore. That resolves it for me if I just avoid the controversy. Or I can say, well, it was by vision. Well, that's an explanation. So as long as we can find an explanation for it, and believe me, no matter what evidence you could present to these believers, there's always an explanation. There's always a way around it. So we'll never get anywhere by that, perhaps. It just takes time. It's going to take many years before maybe they all see it. So what happens also when prophecy fails is they actually increase their proselytizing. So the excitement of the belief system drives evangelism. New converts that come in particularly can get real excited about any of these groups. And so that freshness that comes in, that drives the proselytizing. They may go out there and proselytize on their own because of the belief that they've latched onto. It's that train of thought that they get into. It's not necessarily Christian, but it's the train of thought for the group. In William Branham's case, it's the message of the hour, and that you've got some special mysteries and that you're doing things some denominations aren't practicing, and that makes you special, and you've got to get everybody in because everybody's got to hear the prophet. So as a new convert, you're going out there telling everybody about it because you're committed to it. So you also become more publicly committed to the belief system. And when things fail, because you have to save face in the public's eye, because otherwise the public's going to discredit you altogether. So you have to become publicly committed to this in the face of opposition. And a lot of times you'll reframe it, public opposition to yourselves, as persecution. So the failure gets totally renamed as confirmation. When you can add all these elements together, then people say, well, it was just confirmation of the prophecy. It's not a refutation in their minds.
That's just it. The mind is not allowing for critical thinking about the prophecy when you're in one of these groups. You mentioned the Los Angeles prophecy. I want to talk about that just a bit because that's a good example for what I was referring to earlier with regards to integrity. So for people who don't know, people who are unaware, William Branham claimed in 1965 that he had a vision from God. Los Angeles was going to sink before beneath the ocean, and then started giving details about that prophecy in various sermons. And the details themselves aren't quite correct. He said that Los Angeles would sink, and he had received this vision from God. Sometimes he says it was Jesus speaking, and he says something to the effect that as Capernaum sits beneath the sea, so also shall Los Angeles sink beneath the sea. I'll never forget whenever I was watching National Geographic one day and saw Capernaum. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, it's supposed to be beneath the sea. I had no idea that it wasn't beneath the sea, because the only thing that I had as a frame of reference to Capernaum was what William Branham said. And I got to studying everything that he said about it, and I started noticing, man, there's just some real huge flaws here. The biggest of which, like you mentioned, he said, according to what Billy Paul said, and I knew Billy Paul personally, he said that before you are an old man, sharks will be swimming right where you're standing. In fact, if you read the Acts of the Prophets book, it says exactly this: return now to the day when Brother Branham turned to Brother Billy Paul and said, Billy, all I can say is that God has told me no different about Sister Florence. And then he says, right after making this statement, he turned to his son and said, Billy, where are you standing? And Billy Paul replied, downtown Los Angeles. And William Branham said, where are you standing? And Billy Paul said, in front of the May Company, downtown Los Angeles. And at that point, it says, at this, Brother Branham made a prophetic statement, Billy, I may not be here, but you won't be an old man until sharks will swim right where we are standing. Now, I've been to Los Angeles, and I have stood outside of the May Company. And now it has changed. It's no longer even the May Company. It's something else. I've stood right there where this allegedly took place, if this even took place. The problem is, it didn't take place. Billy Paul was an old man. At the point of time I was there, he was still alive. but he later died. So he became not only an old man, he aged until death. And the way that the cult has spun the death is that he died of old age, which is really, really ironic if you think about it. That doesn't quite match with the certificate of death that I have. There were some complications that caused the death, of which he was supposed to be healed, which leads me to the circular reasoning of understanding. After his death, this, as you know, created a huge problem in the cult following of William Branham. There were ministers who actually said something to the effect, well, it was true, it did come to pass, because they had a shark tank inside the building. But if you think about the prophecy itself, it said, where are you standing? And he says, in front of the May Company, downtown Los Angeles. So the ministers who are fully aware of what he said, what was said in this prophecy, would try to argue that there was a shark tank inside, meaning that the prophecy was incorrect. He wasn't in front of it. He would have had to have been standing inside for the shark tank to be there. Now, to the average person who's never heard this prophecy, they're thinking, what on earth? Why are they even trying to defend this? The guy was old and died. But it's all about that integrity. The brain, even a person who has integrity or thinks they have, when they try to respond to a failed prophecy and they're under that level of mind control, their brain will automatically defend it, whether they're being would have defended it. There, in other words, when you're under that level of mind control, you have a critical person, you have a critically thinking self-identity that's inside of you, but you have the group's identity which is suppressing this. And the group's identity is telling you, don't test the prophets, touch not God's anointed, all of those phrases, all of that loaded language that's in your head. But you cannot test it. You cannot critically think of it. And so what happens instead, you'll give circular reasoning defenses. This can be true because of this other thing, and ignore, you know, every detail that's incorrect in the prophecy. Ignore that Capernaum is still standing and has never, ever been under the sea. We saw a shark tank. So that's what I'm referring to when I talk about integrity.
So why do believers stay when these things happen? There's five key conditions that I'm going to mention here that makes us believe persistence more likely after a failure. First of all is very strong convictions. You know, the fact that these are Christians we're talking about in the message, for instance, and even other pseudo-Christian groups, they obviously believe in Jesus. They don't know maybe what Jesus they're believing in, as we pointed out last time. These groups don't know what Jesus they're actually believing in. Many are believing in a false Jesus, say one that was created by God or one that was birthed out of God that was not eternal in the heavens. So, but they do have this strong conviction because we know Jesus was real. Christians do. So they have a personal identity with it, and it attaches to their belief system within the message or the cult that they're part of. And then they've also got a public commitment now, because if they sold their goods, if they left their jobs, if they're not associating with the people of the world, if they're condemning denominations, they've got to have a reason for it. So publicly, they may have to explain themselves, why do you do this? So if they left the group after a failure, they would face embarrassment a lot of times. So their public commitment makes themselves very tied in with the group. There's also the sacrifices that I mentioned, you know, selling their possessions. That becomes an irreversible action. When you've sold everything you have and put all your eggs in this basket, it's very costly then to leave what you've given all for. Very costly psychologically. It would almost break you down psychologically. And we know many that's come out of the message that had once given all that they had to the message. They've had a lot of psychological challenges. And so it's very costly, and that's no doubt. Also, another thing that keeps them bound to the group is social support. You know, you've got a lot of times all your family, a lot of these churches within the message, perhaps, and I know this for a fact, are families. You know, the whole church is built upon families. It starts out maybe with the dad, who has lots of children, and then they get married and have lots of grandchildren, and then they get married and have lots of grandchildren. So the ones that hang on in there are mostly family. And then you've got other churches that are not so much like that, but they've attracted a lot of the people that are dissatisfied in their own churches. And then you get the social support system that goes on. Now they support one another, and that's very strong too in any group, non-Christian or Christian alike. Even say in your job, which is totally secular, you have a support structure there that you, if you like the people you work with, it's very strong. And it keeps you employed there. It's why you don't leave the job a lot of times. And then also when failures happen, they throw a lot of ambiguity in there. That's where you try to reinterpret the prophecy, or you say, well, you just didn't see it the way it should have been seen, or all these things they can bring in. It brings in a lot of ambiguity. So then, even though it's clearly disproven, the believers are held on because there's been so much ambiguity brought in from the pulpit about it, and it fogs the issue. So people can never overcome, you know, and if they're not prone to go outside and study on their own, you know, they're going to hold on to the belief system. So when all five of these are present, that just intensifies the belief system greatly. It never collapses at that point. One or more of these can be present to hold you there, but when all five are present, then the intensity there is great.
Exactly. And one of the things that I'll mention here is that every group, no matter which church you're in, may have to some level some of the things you've talked about. You talked about the family. So why am I this particular denomination, one person might say? Because my father was, and his father before him, and his father before him. And this person will likely be in that denomination for the rest of their lives because they have this family history. Does it mean the denomination is true? Does it mean it's false? Neither. This person is here simply because of the family. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, I want to point out. But when you combine everything that you just said, and the people are trained not to critically think, that's where the problem comes in. Because whenever there is an issue, whenever you do discover something, then you have been trained not to examine the truth and throw away the faults. Back to the person whose father was in the group, you know, his father before him, and etc. If that person were to come in contact with something that's incredibly destructive, some critical information that, oh my gosh, I'm in error, usually in a group that doesn't have all of the things that you're talking about, usually the people will think through the error. Now, they may remain in the group, they may not, that's a different story, but they at least think through it, and they have no hesitation to think through it. But when you're in one of these groups that does not allow you to think about the things that have been spoken from behind the pulpit as God's truth, whenever God's truth isn't true, what do you do with this? And for me, like I said, it goes back to the integrity.
Next time, we're going to really get into more of the background. I apologize that we can't get into the false prophecies yet, but this background is essential. And there's some great comments that's going to be made, you know, in the next episode when we get into more of this background and why people stay and hold on to the belief systems that they either grew up with or came into and then sacrificed everything they had to be a part of. And we're going to learn exactly the psychological makeup of the people and why they stick with it. And it's just present in all of us, really. So I look forward to it and talking to you the next time, and we'll get right into it the next episode.
Sounds good. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more information about Roy Davis and William Branham, you can read The Persuasive Preacher, The Gifted Prophet, and The Noble Politician. And for more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.